This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Foreign-born farm workers are vital to the American food supply. They hand-pick most of the produce that ends up on our plates, but their lives and labor still remain more or less invisible. My guest today is working to change that. Ramon Zepeda grew up in a small farming community in Jalisco, Mexico. His family farmed the land and raised cattle. But his father also went back and forth between their hometown and the United States. He worked in steel plants, meatpacking plants, and on farms to make money to send back to his family. Eventually, he brought the whole family to the U.S., and Ramon learned quickly what it felt like to be a foreigner in a new place. Everyone had to pitch in. Ramon has since devoted his life to working to help underrepresented workers. In high school, he helped start a club to support other migrant students. And in college, he documented the working conditions at a North Carolina pork processing plant. Today, he's a program director at Student Action with Farm Workers and joins me in the studio today to talk about his commitment to social justice and how he got from Jalisco, Mexico to Rayford, North Carolina. Ramon Zepeda, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank, and good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's very nice to have you. Take us back to that childhood in the state of Jalisco, Mexico, in a small village, was it? Tell us about growing up there.
Yeah, so I am a Tapatío. That's what we call people that are from the state of Jalisco in Mexico. I lived there for my childhood, 10 years. When I was 10, I moved to L.A., but I did live in a very agricultural town. I grew up with my grandfather, my dad, and my uncles and older siblings working in the land, living off the land pretty much, working the corn with cattle and other crops that we used to grow there.
You were only there until you were 10, but you were working the farm?
Yes. Even since I could walk, I remember even just walking behind my grandfather when he was sowing the seeds in the field or going with them to milk the cows in the morning. I was doing all of that at an early age.
So how many brothers and sisters?
I'm from a family of eight. Now we are seven, but yeah, big family, eight. I'm right in the middle.
But your father would leave periodically. He'd go to the U.S. At first, he would go back and forth. He was not legal when he went in. But tell us a little bit about his excursions, why he left for the U.S., and how long he'd be gone.
Yeah, so my dad decided to come back and forth to the U.S. to work and, you know, make money to send back home. And also, eventually, I know he wanted to bring over the whole family. A lot of the people in our hometown had done that. A lot of our relatives had crossed over to the U.S. and they would come back and we would see them. So, of course, there was that sort of temptation, but also knowing that it was a struggle to continue to make ends meet and survive, that we decided. My dad actually was the first one with his brothers to come over, and eventually he brought the rest of us.
Mm-hmm. What would it have been like? I'm trying to imagine why he would do that. You had a farm, you said, mm-hmm. right? And you're growing food. Were you able to support yourselves with that?
I remember we were able to eat. We had enough to feed ourselves. It was still very hard. It was a very rural town, and we depended a lot on corn and the crops that we could grow. Of course, it depended on the seasons. You know, I remember there were dry seasons or, you know, good seasons, bad seasons. So it was never easy, I would say. And farm work in general is hard work. But I know that my dad wanted to come over to make more money, to somehow provide better opportunities for us. And I learned recently after talking to him more about it that they were also, and my grandfather was in debt most of the time because we did have a crop, but most of the time we had to get loans from the bank for the fertilizer, et cetera. So it was just a cycle, never really making enough as a profit. So,
what kind of work was your father doing when he went to the U.S.?
Yeah, he came to work in California, and he worked in the fields and eventually settled in L.A. So he worked in some different crops like strawberries or lettuce, and eventually he settled in L.A. and worked in restaurants. So he did work in a Mexican restaurant and taco truck with my uncle, and eventually got a job in a meatpacking plant in L.A. also.
And he'd be gone for how long, usually?
You know, I remember that sometimes he would be a year, sometimes he would be 6 months, that we would see him come to the U.S. and then a year later he would return. But he went, when he would return, it was for a very short period of time because, you know, obviously we missed him and the time just flew by. And he would come when he had slow time and he was able to take a break.
Mm-hmm. What was that like? I hear it's quite a celebration when he came back.
It is. You know, we received a lot of gifts. They were little things, but for us they were like great gifts that we didn't know about or even have in our small little world. But even if it was like a little car or racing car or motorcycle or chewing gum, that was a big thing. I remember my dad used to bring us that yellow neon green looking chewing gum, and that was the most exciting part. I remember that I would hold on to my pack like it was gold.
Was this a family celebration or did the whole community get involved?
Yeah, of course the family was very happy. I remember we would have celebration meals, dinners, but the town was small enough that everybody knew when there was someone from El Norte, from the U.S. coming to visit. So everybody kind of came to visit. The house would get filled up with visitors, old friends of my father. And then, you know, obviously sometimes they would do a bigger party, sometimes often, you know, killing a hog and doing carnitas or chicharrones. That's the whole party.
It had to be pretty difficult for your mom, though, raising eight kids and you know, with your dad gone.
It was. You know, at the time, I believe it was just five of us that were with my mom when my dad had to come back and forth. I had younger siblings that were born here in the U.S., but it was pretty difficult. You know, oftentimes we did not hear or did not know where my father, how he was doing in general, or, you know, how things were going with him. So those are things that I still wonder. But I do know that it was very hard. We depended a lot on my grandparents, on my uncles, other people to give us some corn, or we only had one cow, and that cow gave us enough milk. But my mom would do things like sell snacks or tostadas, the tostadas, and cheese. Whatever she could make, she would make and then sell it in around the town or the neighbor towns to just make a little money, make ends meet.
Well, as you said, at first your father was traveling back and forth without documentation. Ultimately, he was able to go back and forth legally, right?
That is correct. So in 1986, actually, when I was born, my dad was able to apply for his permanent residency card. There was an amnesty in 1986, so he was able to apply and get his permanent residency, and eventually he applied for the rest of the family, and we came over. It took about a decade, though.
I'm wondering how you felt about that. As he's coming back, he's bringing cars and chewing gum, and you're a 10-year-old boy trying to imagine what was the perception of, first of all, of the United States and of the people who were going there.
Yeah, there was this whole myth that people would come to the U.S. and money was so easy to get and people were pretty much sweeping money off the ground or something like that. Or that was the perception. People thought that it was easy to get a lot of money because they would see visitors that would come from the U.S. back to our hometown with things that we could not get so easily that were really expensive.
Must have been difficult, though, for your father to work. Was he telling those stories, how hard it really was?
No. He didn't really share much about what it was like, what life was here on this side. And, you know, I still want to ask him a lot of questions about it. But, you know, working with a lot of farm workers today that are, I remind me a lot about my dad. I do know about the sacrifices that a lot of, you know, people make when they're on this side and sometimes going without eating so that they can go back one day and share everything that they have saved up or sent for their families.
I mean, do you think he would consider that just not an appropriate thing to do, to complain about how hard it is?
Or? Maybe, or maybe he was just excited to be there with us, but I never heard him really complain. It was just always like, things are good in El Norte.
So eventually, as you say, it was a long process, but he got the whole family over and he did it in shifts. How did you all then end up in Los Angeles?
Yeah. So he was living and working in Los Angeles and he did it by shifts. He first brought my mom and my younger sisters. And that was also hard, you know. Then I was separated both from my mom and my dad and my, you know, sisters. And he brought all the older ones. I arrived in 1997 to L.A. By that time, my dad had been working at the meatpacking plant for a while, so it was a pretty stable job. My mom, at that point, had started working And I forget the word. She was sewing clothes, mm-hmm. sewing clothes in a factory. Mm-hmm.
So what was it like now? Now you're finally in the United States, this mm-hmm. place where we can sweep the gold off the streets. You're in East L.A. What was that transition like for you?
It was definitely a culture shock. And one story that I will always remember is the first day when we arrived, we spent about a week in the border going through all the paperwork. And, you know, I was privileged to be able to get my permanent residency and cross the border that way. But when I arrived, I remember the first thing that my dad told me, my uncle had some food trucks out in the parking lot. And my dad told me to go look and dig through the trash and collect aluminum cans that we were going to make some dollars. And I realized, okay, this is how people sweep money off the streets.
Ramon Zepeda, Program Director at Student Action for Farm Workers, making the transition from the state of Jalisco, Mexico, to East L.A. We'll find out how he got from there to Rayford, North Carolina, and beyond when our conversation continues on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, talking with Ramon Zepeda. He is Program Director at Student Action with Farm Workers, a nonprofit that's been working to improve farm worker conditions for more than two decades now. He was born in a small town in the state of Jalisco, Mexico, moved to L.A. when he was 10 years old, and found out just how you can sweep money off the streets. It's in the form of aluminum cans. So now there it is. This culture shock is now complete. You're in East L.A. What was it like then? You had to go to school. How was that experience for you?
Yeah, that was tough. It was definitely a culture shock. In my hometown in Mexico, which used to be an old hacienda, there was a small school. I only had six peers in my class. I was in the fourth grade, going on to the fifth grade. When I arrived in L.A., I entered a school that was thousands. So obviously, I felt very intimidated. I didn't know the language. It was new people. And I came from a really small town to a huge city. So I definitely felt scared a little bit, insecure, but I had my family with me, so that was a good part.
And a large Latino community.
Of course, yeah. Everybody, every corner, every street, there was somebody speaking Spanish because it's East L.A., it's like Little Mexico. Yeah.
I mean, it's sort of interesting to think about coming from a rural area to that the big shock is being in a city, but in fact, at least the language and some of the customs mm-hmm. are familiar. And there was a bit of a divide, those families that had been there for a generation. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I found in my personal experience when I was going to school and I was taking English classes, English is a second language, I found it to be sort of, I didn't realize how people had those prejudices towards people that were newcomers and were more from El Rancho, from rural areas in Mexico, not so much from the city. And my peers that had been born here that were from Mexican families as well, or their families had migrated before them, that knew English well, that had been here and knew the customs and the culture, sometimes they would pick on us, the ones that, you know, were newcomers and didn't know the language, that were struggling, or that had a certain attire, that would dress more like rancheros or cowboyish, like, you know.
Mm-hmm. So yep, the fact that you were from, the country identified you, you know, immediately. And it was a rough neighborhood, and that's something mm-hmm. that concerned your father.
Yeah, absolutely. We were right in the heart of East L.A., so there were a lot of, there's a lot of gang violence, and my dad would never let me get out on the street on my own. We had a gate and a fence, and I spent most of my time there playing, but it was a rough neighborhood. A lot of gang violence. Some of my peers in school, after we transitioned to middle school and high school, I saw that they started getting involved with those crowds. I never myself, you know, got involved, but I was in the middle of that. There's definitely sometimes people pulling me there, pulling me here. But my father was always very strict, which I think that's what helped me stay at home.
What were you making of all of it, though? This had been some kind of a dream, I guess, or at least to see the United States. Now you're there. Did you want to stay? Did you want to run? You're thinking about, when can I go back? When can I go home?
Yes, I always wanted to go back. Mm-hmm. I thought about the day, and I dreamt about the day of when we would go back to calm and peace and peaceness. I was very, I guess, scared, most of the time, because I didn't know what would happen next. I guess I was just intimidated. I grew out of that. I think after I learned English and I was able to communicate better, I learned to navigate things better. But I was definitely a little intimidated. Didn't know what could happen. I didn't feel very safe.
What about your relationship with your father? He had had to come and go to make some money and send it back to the family. Now you're all living together. Did you have a closer relationship with your father?
Yeah. I mean, of course, just being in same with him in the same house and with my mom as well. I think we did get closer. I got to know him better, but I'm still getting to know him. You know, there's still a lot of stories that I want to hear and share with him. But definitely, I started helping him out with things that I didn't know that he was doing, you know, like collecting cans or even cardboard. We would also sell cardboard, or going with him to his job on Friday afternoons and help him sell seafood. That was another way that he would make a little bit of extra income. He would sell to his peers ceviche or shrimp cocktails. So just learning about the different ways. He's kind of an entrepreneur, like a business person in some way, you know.
And this was while he was working at the meatpacking plant, right?
Yeah, he was working at the meatpacking plant, and he would tell his coworkers, Friday afternoon, I'm going to be there in the parking lot with my truck. At one point, he also actually bought a tent, and we would put the tent out in the parking lot, and people came in, and we sold a lot of seafood.
I was going to say, pretty big business?
It was.
But you also began noticing who was buying and the conditions, or started to infer from the people you saw what kind of conditions they were working under.
Yeah. I mean, I would often, every day I would see my dad coming home with, you know, bloody boots and clothes, because he worked in the kill floor, you know, with all the cows getting slaughtered and processed and all that. So when I would go with him to the plant, I saw all the workers coming out with their hard hats, with their bloody clothes and boots. Obviously, I knew that they were killing big animals in there. And I started to notice those things, but I didn't hear much about the working conditions, just from that what I would notice.
Workers themselves, I'm guessing, bore the marks of working in a plant like that because of the injuries that they sustained. Anything that, you know, I'm wondering I used to work at a factory, and the first thing I noticed going in was a lot of guys didn't have all of their limbs. You know, it was striking to me to see so many people with, you know, missing fingers and missing hands or missing parts of their hands.
Yeah, I don't remember noticing that when I was with my dad in L.A. helping out with his seafood business.
Yeah.
I noticed that definitely when I got more involved after I moved to North Carolina and I was involved with meatpacking workers here.
Well, talk about that move to North Carolina. Why did you decide to come here?
Yeah, my dad actually lost that job at the meatpacking plant. They closed it down. So at this point, you know, it was harder for him to get another job that had the same pay, same benefits. And my mom was still working, but it was still difficult to make ends meet. So we decided to think about other options, other places to go. And we had family here in North Carolina, in Rayford, in Hoke County, North Carolina. And my mom and I came to visit one summer, visit my aunt and uncles, and my older sister actually had moved to live with my aunt. But when my mom and I came to visit, we really liked it, so we went back, and my dad didn't have a job yet, so we convinced him, and we said, you gotta move, and there's other job opportunities there. It's nice, it reminds us of Mexico, because there's more like landscape, there's green, there's trees, it seems more rural. There's not just smog and buildings.
Well, that would be an interesting move. I mean, now you're in a place that looks more like your hometown, but I would think the Latino community at that time might have been much smaller.
It was very small. I was in my 11th year, junior in high school, and I remember that there were about 20 Latino students in my high school in Rayford. So it was definitely really small. And the majority of the other students were African American or Lumbee Indian, American Indian actually, and some Caucasian too. So it was another culture shock.
Well, what was it like for you?
I was better this time because I knew the language. I knew English. I was actually just adapting to the new culture here in the South and new peers. I helped out a lot with my peers that were taking ESL classes that were struggling with the language because I identify with that. So I remember spending a lot of time tutoring and helping out in that way. That's how I got involved with the migrant education program as well. My family had done farm work here in North Carolina when we first moved, and we were part of the migrant education program, which is a federal program that provides support for migrant families and students. And through that, I got a lot of support, motivation, and I helped to also contribute in a way.
What kind of work was your father doing then in Rayford?
Mm-hmm. He started working in a farm, taking care of farm animals. My mom did at some point tobacco and blueberries, and eventually they transitioned to work in a factory. So now they work in a factory making mattresses for babies, actually.
So the family's mostly all here in Rayford now working. You're getting more involved. You're doing some tutoring and connecting with students. When did you decide to sort of become involved in the kind of activist work that you're doing now? Were those ideas taking shape back then, do you think?
Yeah. While I was involved with the migrant education program, I saw how a lot of my peers were really, struggling, dropping out. And I was about to drop out as well. I was in a different situation, but had similar experiences. A lot of my peers had to work before and after school because their families, were dependent on them also to contribute. So I could relate to that. A lot of them have moved from state to state, so it was difficult for them to have a good education when they had been to so many schools. But I was able to get great mentors and that supported me. And I met a couple of people from SAF, Student Action with Farm Workers, when I was still in high school. And they led a workshop about graduating college and becoming leaders. And we went back to our high school and we started a club, Action, Inspiration, Motivation, the AIM Club. And it was for migrant students. Of course, we welcomed everyone, but our focus was to try to motivate our peers to finish high school and hopefully attend a college and get a higher education. After I did, and I was one of them, I honestly needed that. I needed someone to hold my hand and walk me through the process. So I had a good mentor. And my parents, did not have the opportunity to go make it that far. And I felt like I just needed to drop out and work. But someone told me that I needed to do it, that I needed to invest and spend 4 years in college, and then I'll be able to help my family more.
Well, tell me more about that, because, I think for most people who grew up in this country, the idea of not going to college the idea of going to college seems pretty natural because, that's the way, the best way to make a living if you think it through. But talk about the pressures and why you would assume that you should actually stop and help contribute to the family income before you even finish high school.
Yeah, all of this time, I remember my older siblings and even myself when I was 10, since I started collecting cans, we all just worked and contribute to help my parents, to help the family, to make ends meet if it was through paying a bill, through bringing food to the table, or sometimes just to have spending money. So I had the pressure all the time. I often saw my parents behind on bill payments or, things like that. That I feel like it was better for me to drop out and work full time so that I could have a full paycheck.
So the idea that you would say, well, I know you're struggling now, but I'm going to just take 4 years off here, spend a little money add to our debt and then things will work out even better. That's a pretty tough argument to make even to yourself.
Yes. Yeah. My mentor told me you have to show your family tough love. And I was like, what is that? And she told me, 4 years you might not be able to work and help them, but after that you'll have a college degree and you'll hopefully have a better paying job and then you'll be able to take him to a dinner. That's what she told me, take him to a nice steak dinner. And I remember that just made sense to me at the time. I was like, I see what you're saying. I need to invest in this college degree.
Well, you had in this time while you're trying to make up your mind and going through these these decisions. You were working at a gas station at one point. You had a pretty difficult conversation with your boss. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I had different jobs. And when I was graduating high school and starting college, I was working at a convenience store, a gas station in rural North Carolina. So I would see a lot of people coming to buy their cigarettes and their beer and stuff like that on a regular basis. But I remember that I was working long hours. And actually, the summer before, I got involved with SAF a little deeper in the summer internship program. The summer before that, I spent working 7 days a week, 12-hour shifts. And not making the right amount of money. I started doing the math and looked at my paycheck at the end of the week, and I showed my boss at the time that it wasn't even adding up to minimum wage. So I was like, there's something wrong with this picture. You know, I like working here, but I'm working a lot of hours and I don't think it's right. And that's not even including overtime pay, because I was working like 80 hours. He was shocked and surprised that I had done all that math and that I said that and brought it up. He said to me, "Well, you're one of the smart Mexicans." I said, "What do you mean?" And he didn't respond to that. Instead, he says, "Well, we can do that. We can pay you the minimum wage, the amount that you are asking for. But that means that we're going to, you know, account for every hour, we're going to need all your paperwork, your social security and all of that." So he tried to intimidate me that way. But I told him that I was fine with that arrangement. I could do it.
He was surprised to know that you were here legally. Mm-hmm. I'm guessing he meant you're not going to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. And here you say, well, no, here it is.
Yeah.
So what did he do?
I think that I don't remember that we fixed it. I think I never was able to get the raise or the amount that I thought was fair. I ended up leaving, of course, and took on other opportunities. But I think he just expected me to continue working. And they did treat me nice. I felt like they were nice to me. But when it came down to the bottom line, they were not being really honest about it.
No, and obviously willing to exploit your vulnerability. Then at that point, did you wonder if this is a broader picture than just you?
Obviously, yes, because I knew a lot of people. And a lot of my peers, I mean, I was privileged, again, to be working in this air conditioner. You know, we had an air conditioner in the gas station, but a lot of my peers were working in farm work. I knew that the conditions out there were pretty terrible. So I did start thinking about the bigger picture. If this can happen to me, where I thought I felt like the job was safe and secure, imagine what's happening outside, you know, in the field.
So then tell us about that internship, the first internship you had with Student Action with Farm Workers, or SAF.
Yeah, that was in 2005 after my freshman year in college. I remember like it was yesterday, 10 years ago. But I was selected to participate in the Into the Fields program, and I was placed to work in Morganton, North Carolina, with the Western North Carolina Worker Center. And that summer, I thought it was a little odd because I was working mainly with poultry plant workers when all of my peers were working with field farm workers. But that summer, I definitely learned something that changed my life. I learned about workers coming together and working collectively to make a change in their workplace. There was a union, a labor union in town that summer, reaching out to the poultry workers in that one plant in Morganton and trying to gather enough support and signatures to file a petition to go into an election and get a union and eventually negotiate a union contract with the boss. It was not successful that summer, but I definitely learned a lot from individual workers that would share their stories to me and the conditions that they had to work under in the plant. I got to see some of the intimidation tactics. There was one time that we went out and stood in front of the plant by the gates when workers were during shift change. So the workers from the morning shift were coming out, the workers in the afternoon shift were coming in. So we started passing out flyers to invite the workers to a general meeting to learn about the union. And at first, we were having good conversations. People were taking our flyers, our brochures. And at one point, the security guard comes out and stands right by the entrance. There's a police car, I guess they called the police, just parked on the side of the street. They couldn't tell us to go away or couldn't arrest us because we were in public property. But when that happened, all the workers started putting their head down, ignoring us, and just going by their way, walking to work, not paying attention to us. So that moment to me was important. Like, I realized there's something wrong with this picture. I've heard from workers, and they've shared their stories, and I know that they have real issues. There's the conditions there seem to be terrible, and they want to do something collectively to try to fix that or address that. But yet again, they're being intimidated. The security guard's coming out. The police is being called. They obviously don't want to get involved, don't want to have anything to do with the union at this point.
We'll talk more about those conditions, the efforts by owners to intimidate workers, and how in some cases those organizing efforts can be successful. When my conversation with Ramon Zepeda continues, he's a program director at Student Action with Farm Workers. There's more of the state of things just ahead. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. My guest this hour, Ramon Zepeda. He is a 28-year-old activist working to improve conditions for farm workers in the U.S. Spent time alongside factory workers as well. And we were talking about working in a poultry plant in western North Carolina. What were the conditions there? Because often we hear in every unionizing effort from the owners of the factory that things are just fine here. Workers don't need a union. We're treating them all very well. What were the conditions like?
Yeah, you know, the stories that I would hear from current workers at the time and also former workers that had been fired were, you know, a lot of intimidation tactics. Obviously, the speed of the line was a big issue. They said that they had to work really fast because the chickens were coming down the line, and then they had to make all these cuts. The way that they would describe each cut seemed really dangerous. Working at a very fast pace with a very sharp object, really close to your neighbor, coworker on the side, a lot of times would cause injuries. Also, people would bring up issues with breaks and taking bathroom breaks, not being allowed to do that or get off the line, get off work to take a bathroom break. Also, a lot of the workers that were undocumented would, of course, say that they didn't feel like they could speak up because they could get fired. And so a lot of intimidation, people not being able to get, you know, the response that they wanted when they didn't feel respected on the job was the main issue. A lot of workers just didn't feel that there was dignity on the job.
Mm-hmm. But the idea that you would organize and get a union together is so complicated because of the reasons that you found yourself. That if I'm here to make money for my family and that's my job, the same guilt that you felt over not working and going to school, imagine jeopardizing your job, the thing you're here for better working conditions. So you kind of suck it up and keep going, huh?
Well, that is a reality. A lot of people do think about losing their job, and that's mainly why they hold back from, you know, taking a stand. And those were hard conversations to have. And as a union organizer and advocate, I had to have those difficult conversations. But at the end of the day, you know, it was the conversations ended up being about, you know, why was it so easy for companies to, you know, replace workers when they could? Why didn't instead they slow down the line a little bit or offer, you know, better pay or benefits? The workers were doing the work, were producing, were making those cuts to get the chicken out in nice trays in our supermarket or in the buckets that we get in the fast food places, but the conditions were not really addressed. Instead of addressing issues, workers were being treated as disposable. Right. So, yeah, I never found those conversations to be easy. But at the end of the day, I think it was something that each worker had to decide. And from signing a union card, to taking a stand, to attending a meeting, to speaking publicly, those were steps that they had to choose on their own and decide whether or not they were ready for that, whether or not they wanted to put their job at risk. It was definitely hard.
And how did it turn out?
In that particular campaign, it was not successful. The union was able to get enough signatures and support to go to an election. They did go to file a petition with the National Labor Relations Board, but they lost in the election. The company also started an anti-union campaign, which that's allowed, you know, every time there's a union trying to organize workers in a particular plant or place, the company or the owners also can have an anti-union campaign. And the big difference there is that they have the workers already in the plant. They can have captive audience meetings. They can pull workers from the line and take them to a room and provide a meal and have their attention. They hire consultants. As union organizers, we didn't have that. We had to go out in the community, wait for workers after work or visit them before work. And a lot of times we did not know where they lived. We depended on those worker leaders that really were active and wanted to start a union, getting their coworkers contact information and also getting them to sign their coworkers up for the union. So it was challenging.
What was going on in those meetings? You talked about the advantage that the owners have in a captive audience and, of course, intimidation techniques, mm-hmm. Practices. The police would show up when the cards, on the day that you'd be there with the cards. But what about inside the meeting? Inside the plant, how do those meetings go?
I was never in one of those meetings. I just would hear from workers. I never worked in the plant myself, but workers would say that those meetings were all about negative aspects of unions. So they would show a lot of videos, a lot of examples of how unions were bad and ruining, the country. And often giving, negative information about unions, often focusing only on dues, paying dues, saying if you get a union, you're going to have to pay dues, not really explaining the whole process. Like in North Carolina, it's a right to work state. So even if you have a union in your workplace, you can choose whether or not you become a member and pay dues. But oftentimes it was just that focus, intimidating people, making them feel like there were outsiders coming in to change things and to do things that they were not good for them.
Tell us about getting involved. You were involved in another union organizing activity, and that was at the Smithfield plant in Tar Heel. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this was when I was in college at UNC Pembroke. I worked part-time after the summer internship with SAF in 2006. And after that, I was working part-time with the Smithfield campaign, a big processing plant in southeastern North Carolina. They kill and process 32,000 hogs a day. And about 5,000 people work there. So that's a small town, a small city to make that happen. And that was also a very interesting experience. I started as an intern, and I started by riding along with union organizers and visiting workers and hearing their stories, some of the similar stories that I heard, people complaining about the speed of the line, not enough breaks, getting injured and then getting fired the next day or not getting workers' compensation. So some of the stories were starting to become very similar. And then I started working on a project of collecting worker testimonies, specifically from workers that had been injured on the job. So I spent a lot of time following up with workers that had been visited by the union that had an injury and that wanted to share more information about it. So I would do my follow-up visits, bring a camera. I didn't bring a recorder. I just take a lot of notes, but I would have them explain what happened. So obviously I asked a lot of questions about their work and their working conditions. And then it would come to the point where I would ask about the injury and how it happened. So I got to see a lot of missing fingers, cuts, rashes.
Oh, yeah. I think at that point the turnover rate was very close to 100% a year. But what were you going to do with the testimonies then?
Yeah, we were using the testimonies to raise awareness about what was happening in the plant. There were other actions that the union, the United Food and Commercial Workers, was leading consumer campaigns. They were targeting areas where the Smithfield products were going up north and the grocery stores that bought those products, and making information packets, brochures, and flyers with those testimonies with a picture of the missing finger next to the Smithfield brand bacon, and just to let the consumers know that, this is happening in this plant. Workers don't have a voice on the job. The working conditions are bad, and this is how you get your bacon. Mm. So we were doing a lot of that.
And what about the organizing campaign? That was a long struggle, as I recall, in this state.
Yeah, it took more than 15 years. I know that was way before my time. They had previous campaigns, and they had gotten enough support to go to elections. The stories that I've heard from that is that at one point there was an election. It was inside of the plant, and the company shut down the lights and started beating up workers and union organizers. So obviously that was not very successful. And they came back in the 2000s. That was in the 90s. With another campaign that took many, many years. It was really hard getting enough support, just getting enough signatures to file a petition. But there was such a deep history with the company's anti-union practices that people were too intimidated, and there was it was hard. So we started focusing on putting pressure from different parts, from different points, not just organizing the workers inside the plant, but also involving the consumers, involving the communities of faith, involving students, all the stakeholders, all the community, because as we had seen, if the workers organized and were successful, they could easily be beaten down or oppressed or replaced. So we needed to involve people, consumers that pay for those products.
When you you were working with workers, but you also had a kind of rare glimpse at what was going on at the shareholders meeting as well.
Yeah, I also attended a couple of actions that we did in Virginia. The company had its shareholders meetings. I didn't get to go inside, but I was definitely outside. We would bring workers from Tar Heel all the way to Virginia, and we would meet up with a lot of activists and supporters, other union members from the area, and we would march. Some of the supporters were able to go inside of the shareholders meetings to raise questions or, you know, talk about the workers' efforts, trying to put pressure inside the meeting. But most of the time we were outside chanting and marching from the meeting to a place where we would all then listen to workers share their stories. So I did a lot of interpreting and helping workers prepare their testimonies then too.
Eventually that organizing effort was successful, and there's now a union at Smithfield.
Yes. In 2008, the workers successfully voted for the union, and they now have a union contract inside of the plant. And I believe last time I spoke to organizers there are 80% union membership, which is really great.
So tell us what you're doing now. You've been with SAF, Student Action with Farm Workers, full-time since 2011. Tell us a little bit more about the organization. What does your organization do?
Yeah, so we're a nonprofit here in Durham, but we work all over the country, and we have a focus in the Southeast. We bring students and farm workers together to share resources and skills. That's our mission. But what I work on is our summer internship and fellowship program. So every summer I have the opportunity and the privilege to work with 30 young, energetic and excited people that come from all over the country. We recruit from all the states, and they come and spend their summer here in the Southeast in North Carolina, working alongside farm workers and organizations that provide different services to farm workers.
What's the value of that? Why do that?
Why do we do that?
Why do you do that? Have them?
It's a lot of our participants are from farm worker families themselves. Half of them are just like me. So there's a connection there already. That there's a group that has done farm work. They know what the conditions are like, and they see the need for community support. The other half are students that don't come from the farm worker background, but care about the issues, care about social issues. And it's important for two reasons. For one, farm workers are very isolated and don't have access to things like health and education and legal services because they live so isolated. So we need people to go actually and visit them in where they live. A lot of times they depend on transportation from their bosses or their growers that won't bring them that information sometimes. So having a group of people, young people go out there and provide the services is great. But at the same time, we're also able to raise awareness and involve a new generation that hopefully will continue to stay involved. This work as an activist and working for a nonprofit is not very glamorous sometimes. It is hard work, long hours sometimes. But we need people to do this, and a lot of my colleagues I've seen burn out because you hear all these stories, all these conditions like I have from workers, and you can easily get discouraged and you want to do more but you can't. So having new people, young people come and get involved and stay involved for the long run, that is our goal. We want to see them as colleagues one day.
It must be frustrating because we've seen now there's a glitch apparently in the computer works that allow H-2A workers to come into this country. Those are guest workers, essentially, who are legally here to do farm work seasonally. North Carolina farmers depend on them. I guess owing to some computer glitch, they're not making it here, and the harvest is in, and there's nobody to do it. So we see the value of these workers in the state. I mean, there are crops that are going to go unpicked. The last report I saw said about 30% of some of these farmers' crops are going to go wasted. Mm-hmm. So apparently it's very important, but the frustration must be if you're working in unfair conditions, you're just not in a position to organize. You have enormous leverage. We need the food. Clearly, we need the food, or these workers wouldn't be here. And yet you can't use that leverage because of all of these things working against you.
Mm-hmm. You know, that is a good point. I'm not sure what's going on with that computer glitch. But, you know, I do know that the crops are out there. They're going to rot if they don't get picked. And, you know, one thing that I want to point out is say that those workers that are coming with the H-2A visa are a small percentage. They're about, you know, 10 to 14,000 workers out of the 150,000 workers that work in the fields in North Carolina. So there's the huge majority don't come with a visa. So I know that they depend on transportation to get to work as well. So if farm workers are in a very bad situation. They just have to sit there and wait. They can't get to work. But also that for me, that brings up another question, you know, why are we not able to hire people that already live here when, because the pay is not that great, the conditions are not that great. So why can't we focus on improving the working conditions and maybe the pay when we have a lot of people that might be willing to do that? If those conditions were improved. But I'm not sure what's going on with that computer glitch.
I've only got about 30 seconds left, but what for you at the tender age of 28 has been so far your greatest victory, would you say?
My greatest victory?
Yeah.
You know, I think being more proud of my family and my background, there was definitely a point in my life going through all those transitions that I felt sort of ashamed of my Mexican culture because when I was in high school, my peers making fun of me for being from the country in Mexico. But now I feel very proud. And I decided to focus more on the economic, the working conditions, rather than, you know, the superficial things that we see. So that and having my own family now, my wife and son, and living here in North Carolina, it's exciting.
Ramon, great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Frank. It was a pleasure being here.
Ramon Zepeda is Program Director at Student Action with Farm Workers, a nonprofit working to improve conditions of farm workers throughout the United States. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.